More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Anybody know that tune? Okay, I'm glad there's someone out there that does. And now I've got that silly Gravity song running through my head. And I want it, trying to get Psalm 19 back in there. So, oh well. Well, I'll just start by introducing myself, give the least important stuff first. My name is Jim Nance. I teach at Logos School in Moscow, Idaho. I've taught at Logos. Next year will be my 20th year teaching at Logos School. I teach logic, physics, calculus, and rhetoric. And I also teach an online logic course for homeschoolers. I just started that last year. Really, really enjoy it. I had 11 students, had a great time. Hoping I can do it again, but I don't have any students yet. So if you know anybody that is looking for an online logic course, I teach one, and I've got room, lots of room. Send them in. Before I moved to Moscow, I lived in Seattle. I worked as an engineer at the Boeing company. And while I was there, I met my wife, Giselle. We have four children, Jamie, Josiah, Jacqueline, and Jonathan. Jamie, my oldest, is going to be a junior at the University of Idaho. She's studying computer science, and she works at the Economic Modeling Specialists Incorporated, EMSI, in town, as a computer programmer. Loves that sort of thing. My son, Josiah, will be a senior at Logos next year. My daughter, Jacqueline, will be in 10th grade. My youngest, Jonathan, will be in my logic class, so I finally get to teach Jonathan logic. I will have taught all four of my children logic, which will be a delight. Okay, well, let's get started. In this, let's start with prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you very much for your blessing upon us so far. Father, thank you for all the delightful things that we've learned. We thank you for the people that we've met, the fellowship we've enjoyed. Father, thank you for your goodness to us. You give us so many good gifts far beyond what we've asked or deserved. We ask your continued gift to be given to us now and helping us to understand how you would have us think about logic and the teaching of it in the different classes in our schools. In Jesus' name, amen. In this talk, I will be introducing some of the more important tools of learning that a logic class should give to students in the PERT stage. By tools of learning, I mean particular methods or techniques by which a student is able to learn a subject. Tools that allow students to teach themselves. And that, I think, is what Dorothy Sayers means by tools of learning. In her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning, one of the stated goals of classical Christian education is to give students these tools of learning and to teach them how to use these tools properly. Sayers wrote, "The whole of the Trivium was, in fact, intended to teach the pupil the proper use of the tools of learning before he began to apply them to subjects at all. First, he learned a language. Not just how to order a meal in a foreign language, but the structure of a language, and hence of language itself, what it was, how it was put together, and how it worked. Secondly, he learned how to use language, how to define his terms and make accurate statements, how to construct an argument, and how to detect fallacies in argument. Dialectic, that is to say, embraced logic and disputation. Thirdly, he learned to express himself in language, how to say what he had to say elegantly and persuasively." So we see that the purpose of the Trivium was to teach students how to learn. And primarily, she's speaking about it in terms of how to learn a language. And so for the second stage of the Trivium, we're told that there were four specific aspects of language that a student was to learn in this second stage in logic. And those four steps were to define terms, to make accurate statements, to construct arguments, and to detect fallacies in argument. Now, for each of these aspects of language appropriate to the logic stage, there are a set of tools of learning, what I would consider tools of learning, and I would like to introduce some of these tools this hour. Now, I'm only going to introduce them. We're going to take a quick glance. I, of course, don't have time to teach all these tools of learning. That would take a year-long logic class. But I do want you to see them. I am going to introduce them to you and then hopefully spur you on to further study and reflection. Now, the tools that I will present are aimed at the logic stage or PERT stage pupils, meaning that these tools are best introduced and taught to students in junior high, in middle school, around 13 or 14 years old. Now, those of you who have taught students of this age or who are parents of children of this age, you know that their minds are developing and changing. I have, as I said, four children. My youngest, Jonathan, is 13. He'll be in my logic class next year. So I've seen children and my own students go through this transition many times. And what does it look like? First, PERT stage students become more analytical and critical. They used to be content with learning to know a truth, to gain knowledge, but now they want to understand things. My son was once content to learn that God was omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. But when he reached this stage, he started asking more questions. He wanted to understand that. You know, how can that be, Dad? If God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, then how can he be that way and yet allow evil to exist? How can he be that way and yet we have free will and that sort of thing? And PERT stage students are becoming more critical. They like to point out errors, point out inconsistencies. I've learned that they have stronger opinions about different issues, and so their minds are developing in that way. Secondly, PERT stage students want to be able to prove what they've been told to be true. Having come to believe a truth, they now want to know how they can be sure it's true. A common challenge from young teens is, how can you prove that? Can you prove that's true? How do we know that's true? And young people derive, I think, a great satisfaction from being able to prove things. I remember myself as an eighth grader sitting in pre-algebra class or algebra class, looking at in the same room that geometry was taught, and looking at those geometry proofs that were left on the chalkboard, and looking forward to being able to prove those things. I said, I just can't wait for geometry where I can prove the sort of things that they get to prove. The idea of being able to prove something beyond what I was told, something beyond what was obvious, was very intriguing to me, and I think it's that way to a lot of kids at this age level. Third, students at this age enjoy more abstract reasoning. Their teachers can give them problems that are increasingly abstract and complex, and they're able to handle it. And they're even able to enjoy such problems. Now, I'm not saying at this point that all of a sudden students are able to reason abstractly. You've got to understand that everybody reasons abstractly. All children reason abstractly because they all can talk. To be able to talk and to be able to say that's a chair, and that's a chair, and that over there is a chair, there's an abstraction happening in there already. To be able to say that a whale is a mammal without having a whale in front of you is reasoning abstractly. To be able to picture a number without having to picture a number of physical objects is abstract reasoning. So that abstraction, word and number, is a natural part of language. But at the PERT stage, they begin to enjoy reasoning abstractly. They're more comfortable using reasoning and abstract reasoning to solve problems. You know, before, they liked to just learn things by heart. Well, now they want something a little more abstract than that. So PERT stage students are more analytical, critical, and abstract in their thinking. And rather than reacting against these natural changes, we as classical educators should take advantage of them. But how? How does classical Christian education take advantage of these developments? If students are going to be more analytical and critical, then we should give them material to analyze and critique and teach them to do it well. And one way we do this is, of course, through class discussion. Teachers and students looking together at arguments and proofs and working through them. And we need to understand that arguments are everywhere. When you make any decision, there's a little argument going through your mind, because an argument is simply drawing some sort of conclusion. It's the verbal expression of reasoning. And so we should lead our students through arguments, and we'll see some examples of arguments. In all analytical discussions on any subject, the teacher should be leading the students in the following thought process about what they're learning. What's the conclusion being made, and what are the premises being used to support that conclusion? Now, the different subjects that we teach, history or Bible or science, give us plenty of material for analytical discussion. So let me give a couple of examples. First, an example from history. The colonists in America believed that they should declare independence from Britain. What was the conclusion they were making in the Declaration of Independence? The conclusion was that the colonies had a right to be free and independent states and to absolve their allegiance to the King of England. What were their premises to lead to that conclusion? Their premises were that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted from among men, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, that the King of England was indeed trying to seek an absolute tyranny over them. Those were all the premises that led them to the conclusion that we have the right and, in fact, the duty to declare independence from the King of England. Now, once we have the conclusion, and once we have the premises used to support that conclusion, then we can ask the question, does that conclusion follow from those premises? And that's the sort of discussion that if I was teaching history and teaching the Declaration of Independence, that I would want to have with my history students. You know, do these premises, this information, does it indeed lead to that conclusion? And of course, before that, I'd ask them some other questions, which we'll get to in a minute. Or for an example, from science, Galileo believed that objects of different masses will fall toward the earth at the same rate, in the absence of error effects, of course. And what were his premises? Well, he had a different kind of a set of premises. His first premise was an assumption, ran like this. If an assumption leads to a self-contradiction, then that assumption is false. If an assumption leads to a self-contradiction, then that assumption is false. And then he assumed the opposite of his conclusion. He assumed that different masses fall at different rates, and the lighter mass falls at a slower speed, and the heavier mass falls at a greater speed. And then he said, but if you unite the two masses, then the two united masses, having a greater mass, the heavier mass would be slowed by the lighter one, and the lighter mass would be speeded up by the heavier one. Well, if the heavier mass is slowed by the lighter one, then you have a greater mass going at a slower rate. Well, that contradicted his original assumption, and so by his first assumption that if you make an assumption and it leads to a contradiction, that assumption must be wrong. The opposite of his original assumption must have been true, that in fact objects fall at the same speed. You want to hear that again? I should have written it out in here. Anyhow, it was a great example of what's called reductio ad absurdum thinking. You assume the opposite of what you're trying to prove. If that opposite assumption leads to a self-contradiction, then what you're trying to prove must be true. Now, Galileo also proved that conclusion, I believe, by doing experiments. At least he told us that he did experiments. He said he dropped things from a height of 200 cubits, and the heavier one didn't fall by more than a span ahead of the lighter one, and so on. And he gave us actual masses that he was working with. So I believe that he actually did the experiment. And that, of course, is the process of induction. So basically, the idea that I'm trying to get here is with anything the students are studying or reading in school, we should be leading them and asking two questions. What is he trying to prove, and how is he trying to prove it? What is he trying to prove, and how is he trying to prove it? What are they trying to prove? That we should declare independence from the King of England. How are they trying to prove it? What's he trying to prove? That masses fall at the same rate, two different masses fall at the same rate in the absence of error effects. How does he try to prove that? You know, those questions need to be asked, and we need to lead students to ask and answer those questions in class discussion. Discussion is an opportunity to lead students through arguments. So we should give students the opportunity to not only to analyze the arguments of others, but to prove things themselves. We need to be able to teach them how to develop a proper proof. These opportunities occur primarily through student speeches and debates. In every subject we teach, there are possible topics for structured debate. For example, in my daughter's literature class, after reading Julius Caesar, the students debated whether or not Brutus was an honorable man. It's a good subject for debate. It was obviously in the play itself. In science, they debated whether Pluto ought to remain on the list of planets, a classic debate topic. So debates give students opportunity to try to persuade through proofs. Students should also be making presentations. This is another opportunity for developing proofs. Our other science teacher besides me, I teach the physics class, requires his PERT stage students to present their science projects to the class. You know, for years he had them do science projects, and then he said, you know, we really should have a science fair and have them present science projects to everybody else. So we did, you know, went through the big displays and everything. He finally, you know, and he had judges, and it took days to judge all the kids' science fair projects, and it really was a long process. And he finally said, why don't I just have the students do individual presentations to their fellow students as an opportunity for teaching them to persuade through proof. And it was a much more successful idea than trying to just go through the science fair routine. So that's one example. One of our literature teachers had the students make presentations. I sat in on her class this year as she was teaching in my classroom. That students made presentations about authors and poets that they were studying in class. And she had the students make presentations about whoever that they were studying, do the research and so on, and try to make connections between their biographical history and the stories or the poems that they produced. My point here, of course, is simply that as teachers, we should think of debates and presentations as opportunities to give the students practice writing proofs, rather than just opportunities for learning information. This means that we need to teach them methods of writing proofs, helping them to see the difference between a good proof and a poor proof. Third, as their minds are moving from the concrete to the abstract, we can encourage this by giving them practice with abstract reasoning. Obviously, mathematics gives opportunities for abstract thinking. Things like, given this equation, what are the possible values of the variable? Or, given two lengths of the sides of a triangle, what are the possible ranges of the third side? If five people are in a classroom and each of them shakes everybody else's hand, how many handshakes are made? Now, questions like that are best dealt with abstractly. You know, thinking of people not as physical people, but as dots. And handshakes are the lines between the dots. The dots form polygons, and the lines are sides and diagonals, and the number of handshakes would simply be the number of lines in there. How many lines for five? Anybody know how many handshakes are made? What the answer to the question is? 10, yeah, 10. Very good. So the five and the five there. Anybody know if it's N dots, if it's N people, how many handshakes are made? You know the equation? So that's the sort of thing that if you don't know the equation, you know you could figure it out, right? You would draw, you know, six, you know, a hexagon and then a septagon and look at it and you know, draw N and the number of dots down one column and the number of handshakes down the other column, and eventually you'd come up with a relationship and so on. But my point here is that mathematics gives students an opportunity to think through things abstractly and to see how to reason abstractly. In a logic class, there are several possible puzzle-solving games that we play at different times to develop this sort of puzzle-solving abstract thinking. When I'm teaching, for example, about relating terms and defining terms, I just play 20 questions with my students. I play the I'm thinking of something game. And I've realized this gives students practice in thinking in terms of genus and difference type definitions. You know, you start, I'm thinking of something. What's a typical first question that a person would ask? I'm sorry, what? Yeah, how big is it, perhaps? But the classic first question is, and it's not a yes or no question, but is it animal, vegetable, or mineral, right? And that's really going to the genus of the thing. What's the broad genus? And then we narrow down that genus by looking at other properties and accidental attributes and differences that the thing has. And that's that property of reasoning that we go through when we define something. And when I'm teaching logic students about statements and truth value, then I play situation games with the students. And probably most of us have done that sort of thing in school as well. I give a brief scenario, and the students have to ask yes or no questions to try to figure out what's going on. You know, a man passed by a rock. 2 minutes later, he was dead. You know, what happened? And ask me yes or no questions to figure it out. You know, it's a typical scenario like that. And there's whole websites that that can be used to find situation games. I typed in the word situation game and found one. So what that does is give students practice dealing with ambiguities. There's always that tricky ambiguity in the a man passed by a rock, for example. The answer is that he was swimming and he was scuba diving and passing by the rock snagged his tube, and 2 minutes later he drowned, and so on. They always seem to have to do with death. You know, it's one thing I did discover in looking at this website is all the situation games, they were like murder mysteries, I guess. I guess we like murder mysteries. And when I'm teaching propositional logic, we play a mastermind game. We do that with numbers. And I give the students matrix logic puzzles and so on. And those sort of games help students develop propositional reasoning methods. Things like process of elimination, either this or that, not this, therefore that type reasoning, or hypothetical thinking. If this is true, then this further thing has to be true. It's those sort of games that develop this sort of thinking. Chess does the same sort of thing. Chess really teaches us, you know, this or that, not this or that, or if I do this, then he'll do this sort of thinking. So there's lots of puzzles, games, exercises that we can run students through to develop this sort of reasoning that's becoming natural for them anyways. Now, I think we can do the same sort of, receive the same sort of benefit by presenting some of their lessons in other classes as puzzles to solve. Here's one example from Bible that I've used. When studying the cross and studying the death of Jesus, I've challenged my students to try to harmonize the gospel accounts of the crucifixion. Jesus makes 7 statements from the cross. In what order does he give those statements? No one gospel has all 7 of the statements. And so looking at the clues, looking at times, looking at that sort of thing, it's a fun exercise to try to figure out in what order Jesus said the seven things he said on the cross. And I better erase that before you figure out my answer. And how do you justify that order? It's a fun, challenging exercise, and it teaches that same sort of reasoning skill. It's even more challenging, and that's the easy one. The reason I gave that exercise was practice for the really hard one, which is harmonizing the resurrection accounts. Now, how do you harmonize the resurrection accounts between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and especially John? It's a challenging exercise. It can be done. My students do it every year, but it takes a lot of good reasoning to work through. So my point is that Purge Stage students are developing in such a way that they're beginning to enjoy analysis, proof, and abstract reasoning, and so we should teach them how to do these things as we teach not just logic, but all our different subjects. So, the formal tools of analysis, proof, and abstract reasoning are indeed learned in a logic class. This is why Sayers calls formal logic the key exercise of the PERT stage. The key exercise is that subject, that class that teaches students the tools of learning that are appropriate to that stage of the trivium. So I want to do a quick overview of what the most important of these tools are for the logic stage. So first, the tools of analysis and criticism are tools by which we define terms, determine the truth of statements, analyze arguments, and identify fallacies. Let's start with defining terms. Defining terms is a tool of analysis, because in order to tell whether or not an argument is a good one, we need to know what the words of the argument mean. So again, consider the Declaration of Independence. When analyzing this argument, the students read this statement. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, what does endowed mean? What's endowed mean? Someone say it loud. Yeah, to give. Right, okay. And so we think initially that endowed means to give. But it really means something more than that, because to give is too broad. When we give someone food, we don't say we are endowing them. When you give a child food, what are you doing? Yeah, you're feeding them. And to feed is also to give, but you wouldn't use to endow that way. To endow actually has a more specific meaning than that. Can you guess what it is? Yeah, more, to bless is much more closer than that, and using a different method. So to give is more the genus part. To endow is when you give something a little more abstract than food. It's just simply to give a quality, to give a property to someone. That's more the difference part of that genus and difference definition of to endow. To endow means to give a certain quality. And so if I was teaching history and I was teaching students to analyze this argument, we would need to understand the terms first and the meaning of the terms. And we would need to define those terms. And so defining terms is a tool of learning. How would you define that term? Creator. This is simple. Yeah, there you go, right? God, Jesus, Bible. Those three answers, right? Yeah. This is simply defining by synonym. It's another method of defining terms. How about unalienable? What does unalienable mean? Well, that one I would have the students, well, take it apart. What is un? You know, it's not alienable. Well, that means not able to be alienated, which eventually means, you know, something like it cannot be taken away. It can't be separated from. Okay. Well, this is more of a definition by etymology, by looking at the word and looking at the root meaning of the word and so on. And so logic teaches those sort of tools so that we can understand that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, means something like God has given men rights that cannot be taken away. And so defining and the tools for defining are tools of learning. And a formal logic class will teach these and other methods of defining terms, genus and difference, synonym, etymology, example, and so on. Okay, secondly, determining truth. Determining truth is also obviously a tool of analysis and critique. One way to criticize a statement is to say that it's not true. That's how we criticize things. That's, you know, what he just said was not true. It's false. Another way is to say that the argument is invalid, that his reasoning is bad, that the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. And if the premises are true, because if the premises were true and the argument was valid, the conclusion would have to be true. So if you were to analyze and critique the Declaration of Independence, you would need to next consider truth of premises. Are all men created equal? Are the rights of life and liberty really unalienable? Was the King of England, in fact, a tyrant? And so on. And logic teaches methods of determining the truth value of statements. Some statements are considered to be self-evident. In fact, most of the assumptions made by the writers of the Declaration, or the writer of the Declaration, I told you I don't teach history. Was it Jefferson? Okay, thanks. Believed many of these things to be self-evident, that all men are indeed created equal, and that the rights of life and liberty are indeed unalienable, and so on. So some things are self-evident. Some statements we believe to be true because they're supported by induction. One of those was this statement. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. And the next sentence says, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And then he listed all the abuses, all the complaints. And so that's more a process of supporting a truth by induction. Statements can be supported by authority. In fact, I would argue that most of what our students believe, they believe it to be true by authority. You know, what's the capital of France? Paris. Well, how do you know that? You know that simply because you've been told and you believe it. How many planets are there? Well, depends. but some things we know to be true by authority, and there's other methods of determining truth. Again, a logic class should teach methods of determining truth as that key exercise so that the other classes can use these same sort of tools. Okay, analyzing arguments is, of course, the heart of the logic curriculum. Defining terms and determining the truth of statements belong to logic mainly because they support the more central exercise of analyzing arguments. Analyzing arguments means to consider logical arguments to determine if the conclusion really follows from the premises. And so I want to consider some of the tools of analyzing arguments. Logic students are first taught how to identify premises and conclusions in arguments. Now, how do we know that that something is a premise? Well, because it starts with because, or since, or for, or given that, or any of the other sort of phrases that identify that you're using this to support some other statement. How do we identify conclusions? They start with things like therefore, thus, so, hence, in conclusion, clearly, and things like that. And one of the other methods for identifying a conclusion is any statement that's followed by one of the premise identifiers is itself a conclusion. The sentence I am now speaking is a conclusion because it was followed by because. And so statements that do that are also conclusions. So students need to be able to first identify premises and conclusions in arguments before they can go to the next step of analyzing the argument itself. So let's do some of that. Here we have a chapter or a section out of Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, and I want to identify the conclusions in this paragraph. Let me read it first. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end, and this is evident from their acting always, or nearly always, in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence it is plain that they achieve their end not by chance, but by design. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with, there's that word again, knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Now, there's obviously a major conclusion there, but he gets to that conclusion by making some intermediate conclusions. What's the first conclusion here? Say it again. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, that the statement that includes the act for an end. We see things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. We know that's a conclusion in two ways. He says we see that at the beginning, and it's followed by this is evident from. This is evident from, it's like saying because. Things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end because they act always or nearly always in the same ways so as to obtain the best result. Where's the next conclusion? Yeah, they achieve their end not by chance, but by design. What word gives that away? Yeah, the hence, okay? And then what's the major conclusion of this whole paragraph? Yeah, the last one. Some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and that therefore gives that away. So what we see here is Thomas Aquinas is arguing in that straight line. He's drawing a conclusion, then using that conclusion as a premise to the next conclusion, using that as a conclusion as a premise to the next conclusion until he reaches his final conclusion. Well, it's important, first of all, that students simply be able to identify premises and conclusions in an argument. Once they're able to do that, then we can move them on to learning how to determine the validity of an argument. Now remember that validity is not the same as truth. An argument is valid if the premises imply the conclusion. An argument with false premises can still be valid. Okay. Now validity and truth are different things. Here's an example of an argument with a false conclusion, but it's a valid argument. If God existed, there would be no evil. But there is evil, therefore God does not exist. This is a valid argument. If the premises were true, the conclusion would have to be true. Now, we know that conclusion's false, which leads us to know what? Yeah, certainly, at least one of the premises is false. Okay, so there's a difference between validity and truth. Now, because of these sort of difficulties, a large portion of any logic class is spent on learning tools for determining validity. A logic class will spend a lot of time on validity, also because there's different forms of argument. And the two main forms are categorical syllogisms and propositional arguments. So let's look at each of those in turn. First of all, syllogisms are categorical arguments. The classic syllogism from Aristotle, all men are mortal. Socrates was a man, therefore Socrates was mortal. Here's another example of an argument, a categorical syllogism. Some important historical dates are not easy to remember. But all important historical dates are helpful to know. Therefore, some things that are helpful to know are not easy to remember. This is a valid argument. Okay. Well, logic teaches several methods for analyzing syllogisms to determine their validity. And methods include things like rules of validity, and there's five basic rules of validity. Another method is counterexamples. And I'd go into detail here, except I'm doing that in my next talk. So my next talk, I'm going to talk in detail about how to use counterexamples to determine the validity of a syllogism. My talk, Foundations of Formal Logic. So that's one kind of argument, categorical syllogisms, and we're familiar with those. Another type of argument is the propositional argument. Propositional arguments connect whole propositions together using logical operators such as and, or, if then, if and only if, and so on. Now these require a completely different set of tools, although the reasoning is based on the same foundation as that of categorical arguments. Well, here's an example of an argument that would be analyzed using propositional tools. If the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon, and the word coming means his final coming, and soon means within a century, then the final coming occurred before the end of the second century. But of course, the final coming did not occur before the end of the second century. However, the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon. Therefore, either the word coming does not mean his final coming, or the word soon does not mean within 100 years, within a century. Now, how do you analyze that argument? This argument cannot be analyzed using the standard methods of categorical syllogisms. It's a different sort of argument. And so we use methods of propositional arguments. First, we symbolize it. And this is the how you'd go about symbolizing it. If T, the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon, and the word coming means his final coming, and soon means within a century, so you see that the and is the dot, then, that little horseshoe, the final coming occurred before the end of the second century. But we know that the final coming did not occur before the end of the second century, so the tilde is the not, the negation. However, the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon. Therefore, the three dots are therefore, either the word coming does not mean his final coming, or, so the V is an or, the word soon does not mean within a century. So first we teach the students simply how to symbolize arguments like that. Okay? And then we teach a method of determining the validity of the argument. And the method we use is the same method that Galileo used, the reductio ad absurdum method. We're trying to prove that this is a valid argument. So we assume it's invalid. Okay? So that means we assume that the premises, the three premises, are true and the conclusion's false. The not C or not S is false. Well, if you have an or statement that's a false statement, you know that both parts have to be false. Okay, so I'm a garbage man or I'm a woman is a false statement because I'm neither a garbage man nor a woman. Okay, so, and if not C is false, then C is true. And if not S is false, then S is true over on the other side of the argument. Similarly, if T is true there, it has to be true there. That comes from the laws of thought. The first law of thought is called the law of identity, which says if a statement is true, then it's true. Okay? Pretty basic, but really, really important when it comes to truth tables. If a statement is true, then it's true. And then a statement can't be both true and false, so if not B is true, then B has to be false. Okay, so let me run through that again. Okay. So, we make the premises true and the conclusion false. We assume the argument's invalid. If that or is false, then both parts have to be false. If not C is false, then C is true. If not S is false, then S is true. If T is true there, then it's true there. If not B is true, then B has to be false. But now we have T and C and S all being true, the antecedent of that if then being true. The first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon, and coming means his final coming, and soon means within a century. Then the final coming occurred before the end of the second century. But the final coming occurred before the end of the second century is false, so that if then must be false. But we assumed it was true. We get a contradiction right there. And we assumed it's true because we assumed the argument was invalid. Premises true, conclusion false. But that assumption that the argument was invalid led inexorably to this contradiction, therefore the argument must be valid. Okay, so there's a really quick overview of how this method of analyzing arguments looks. It's a very powerful method for analyzing arguments. And again, it's not so important that you follow that. I'm going to talk about this more in my next talk. But you should know that students who learn these methods, this truth table method, will have a tool for analyzing a wide variety of real-life arguments. This particular argument is one that I use in my Bible class when we're talking about the difference between preterism and futurism and so on. Okay. The ability to identify informal fallacies is one of the most valuable and interesting tools of critique in a logic class. When you go look at logic textbooks out there on the book tables, you'll see mine, you'll see Martin Cothran's, and then most of the rest of them will be informal fallacies, informal methods of critique. Invalid arguments that we come across in daily life are not usually invalid in a formal way. Usually there's some sort of fallacy happening, some sort of informal fallacy happening. Things like ad hominem, which means to the man. That's where you verbally abuse your opponent rather than dealing with his argument. Or circular reasoning, assuming what one is trying to prove, arguing in a circle. Or my wife's favorite, post hoc ergo propter hoc. She always thinks that sounds funny. After this, therefore, because of this, for you Latin students. This is assigning a false cause, that's saying just because B follows A in time doesn't mean that B was caused by A. Well, a good logic textbook will teach students these and many other different forms of informal fallacies. And knowing how to recognize and identify fallacies will help students to defend themselves from a lot of bad reasoning that goes on in the public sphere. Now, here's the first time I take a real risk. I'm going to give you 10 different examples of informal fallacies, and all of them are on the topic of global warming. See if any of this sounds familiar to you who read the news. This summer, the temperature in New York is the highest it has been in a decade. A lot of ice is melting in Antarctica. Obviously, the Earth is warming at an alarming rate. What is causing this? Well, in the 20th century, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased, and then so did the overall temperature of the Earth. Coincidence? I think not. Clearly, CO2 causes global warming. Nobody has conclusively demonstrated any other cause. The automobiles in the streets of the nation pump millions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. So if you drive an SUV, you are responsible for the continued warming of the atmosphere. Those who don't accept climate change theories are just crackpots, like those who believe the Earth is flat. They're on par with Holocaust deniers. All reputable scientists believe in global warming, and those who don't believe in global warming are clearly not reputable scientists. We need to spend billions of dollars to stop global warming now, otherwise coastlines will drown in the rising sea, hurricanes will destroy cities, and droughts will kill all life. Global warming is the worst disaster to hit our planet. It's true. Just read what Natalie Portman and Brad Pitt say on the Global Warming Celebrity website. I'm serious. There is one. So you should join the march to stop global warming. It's the newest and coolest method of political protest. And if you don't support this campaign, then you're just another climate change denier. Okay, now there's a lot of informal fallacies in there. In fact, every single sentence I put up was a standard informal fallacy. And it's not hard to find these on the topic of global warming. Now, most of us, on hearing something like this, would know that there was something wrong with the arguments. We would be bothered by those arguments, but we wouldn't be able to say exactly what. But those students who are trained to identify fallacies by name will be able to say what's wrong. They won't be swayed by the fallacious appeals here, and they'll have a response for it. This is what tools of logic do for us. They do what Sayers mentions elsewhere in her essay. She said, "For we let our young men and women go out unarmed in a day when armor was never so necessary. By teaching them all to read, we have left them at the mercy of the printed word. By the invention of the film and the radio and the internet, we have made certain that no aversion to reading shall secure them from the incessant battery of words, words, words. They do not know what the words mean. They do not know how to ward them off or blunt their edge or fling them back. They are a prey to words and their emotions instead of being masters of them in their intellects." Tools of learning will help students to be masters of words in their intellects. Too many students and too many graduates and too many people working in the public sphere now have not learned these tools of learning and are not masters of words in their intellects. Tools of analysis help our students to do this, to identify fallacies, to identify bad reasoning. Tools of proof. Tools of proof allow us to establish a given conclusion. And again, I'm going to look at two different kinds, categorical proof and propositional. Categorical proofs start with a conclusion as a categorical statement and allow us to develop a valid argument to establish that statement as a conclusion. Now, analysis is when you're looking at someone else's argument, an argument that's already there, and asking, does that conclusion follow from those premises? Here we're simply starting with a conclusion, and we're coming up with the arguments ourselves. In a logic class, students will learn that there are 24 valid forms of syllogisms, and there are four different types of statements that can make up those categorical syllogisms. Universal affirmatives, like all dogs are mammals. Universal negatives, like no dogs are cats. Particular affirmatives, some women are teachers. Particular negatives, some men are not lawyers. Okay, four different types of categorical statements. Universals and particulars, affirmatives and negatives. Now, for those 24 different forms of syllogisms, there are four valid forms of syllogisms that have that no S is P type conclusion, that have the universal negative conclusion. And they are these four forms. Now, I mentioned earlier that debates and presentations were good opportunities to teach students to write proofs to establish conclusions. So let's assume that we're doing that. Say a student were in a debate or making a presentation, and he wants to argue that economic sanctions are never an acceptable form of warfare, that it's wrong for a nation to use economic sanctions against an enemy country. And he wants to argue this way. Now, this is a universal negative, and I want to use this method to establish that conclusion. How would you do it? First of all, you teach your students to put statements like this into one of those four forms. This is universal negative, so it would have to be put into the no S is P form. And so it would be something like, no economic sanctions are acceptable forms of warfare. And then you find some valid form and fill in the known terms, leaving that unknown term called the middle term blank. So we know that S lines up with economic sanctions, P lines up with acceptable forms of warfare, so we fill those in. And then all we have left is that middle term. Now, we know that we're trying to prove that that conclusion's true. We have a valid argument form now, so we just need to find a middle term that makes that true. Well, what middle term would work here? No somethings are acceptable forms of warfare, but all economic sanctions are somethings. Therefore, no economic sanctions are acceptable forms of warfare. Well, something like weapons that target civilians could be used. No weapons that target civilians are acceptable forms of warfare, but economic sanctions are weapons that target civilians. Therefore, economic sanctions are never an acceptable form of warfare. That's one possibility. And what students learn in running through this exercise and doing lots of these categorical proofs are that it's the finding of that middle term that's really where the heart of the argument. If someone says economic sanctions are never an acceptable form of warfare, and you say, why? You could simply say, because they target civilians. And just the statement of the middle term is almost the same as giving a proof for that particular statement. Okay, propositional proof. Propositional proof is similar. It also starts with valid forms of arguments. It considers rules such as modus ponens and modus tollens type reasoning, like the rules of validity that categorical arguments use. Modus ponens, if P then Q, P therefore Q, a very basic method of reasoning. Modus tollens is similar, if P then Q, therefore not P. That's the same sort of reasoning as the reductio type reasoning we talked about earlier. Anyways, propositional arguments and propositional proofs use rules like these and others as justifications to show in a step-by-step manner how the conclusion follows from the premises. So let's consider the propositional argument that we saw before. If the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon, and the word coming means his final coming, and soon means within a century, then the final coming occurred before the end of the second century. But the final coming did not occur before the end of the second century. However, the first century Christians were taught that Jesus was coming soon. Therefore, either the word coming does not mean his final coming, or the word soon does not mean within a century. So first, we symbolize those premises, and now we do it with numbers in front and do it from top to bottom. If T and C and S, then B is the first premise, not B is the second premise, T is that third premise, and the conclusion I'm trying to get to is not C or not S. And then it would simply run through the proof. And again, I'm not going to teach what all these steps mean, but basically you can, when you have an and in front of an if then, you can separate that into a combined if then. If T and C and S then B can be turned into if T then, if C and S then B by a rule called exportation. And then we have if T then, if C and S then B in step 4. T in step 3. Therefore C and S then B in step 5. That's the modus ponens type reasoning. And then we have if C and S then B, not B, therefore not C and S. There's the modus tollens reasoning. And now I see I'm losing people. and then not both C and S is the same as saying it's not the case that coming means his final coming and soon means within a century, to bring it back to words again, which means the same as either coming doesn't mean his final coming or soon doesn't mean within a century. And that's a rule called De Morgan's theorem. And so they learn all these rules in order to write proofs like that. Now, the value of that is it the proofs demonstrate the step-by-step reasoning that one goes through to establish a conclusion. And it gives them practice reasoning that way. It gives them practice thinking in a straight line. It gives them practice justifying their thinking. All important skills. The abstract reasoning skills taught in logic help students to think in puzzle-solving ways. They teach students to be careful with the details. So much of logic is simply teaching students to be really careful because the details are really important and logic doesn't let you get away with anything. Rhetoric is different. You get away with a lot in rhetoric, but you can't get away with anything in logic. You have to be careful with the details. It teaches students to use this sort of if-then and either-or reasoning well. It teaches students to spot logical errors. It teaches students to start with a given set of information and to simplify it down to its essentials through abstraction and to apply deductive reasoning to reach valid conclusions. Now, someone might say, that's not really valuable. This is just, you're just playing games. Are these really important? Well, I would argue, here's one way to argue that these are important. Take a look at the Law School Aptitude Test, the LSAT test. This is the test you have to take in order to get into law school. And look at the sort of questions that they want law students to be able to answer. There's three types of questions, multiple choice questions. Logical reasoning, analytical reasoning, that's categorical logic, and propositional logic, and then reading comprehension. And so logic has to do with obviously teaching those first two of the three types of questions that's taught on the LSAT test. Well, in order to demonstrate that, I'm going to give you the first question of the practice LSAT test. A medical clinic has a staff of 5 doctors, Drs. Albert, Burns, Calogero, DeFeo, and Evans. The National Medical Society sponsors exactly 5 conferences which the clinic's doctors attend, subject to the following constraints. If Dr. Albert attends a conference, then Dr. DeFeo does not attend it. If Dr. Burns attends a conference, then either Dr. Calogero or Dr. DeFeo, but not both, attends it. If Dr. Calogero attends a conference, then Dr. Evans does not attend it. If Dr. Evans attends a conference, then either Dr. Albert or Dr. Burns, but not both, attends it. Got that? Okay. Question 1. If Dr. Burns attends one of the conferences, then which one of the following could be a complete... That's important. Logic teaches you to be careful and look at the details. That word complete and accurate, meaning true, list of other members who attend that conference. Drs. Albert and DeFeo. Drs. Albert and Evans, Drs. Calogero and DeFeo, Dr. DeFeo, or Dr. Evans. Now, a student who studied logic, the first thing he's going to do here is to do what they obviously expect you to do and start using symbols. Obviously, they want you to use A, B, C, D, and E here. and he's going to start symbolizing these things to figure out just how the reasoning you go through to answer the question. Is it Drs. Albert and DeFeo? No, it can't be. Look at constraint one. If Dr. Albert attends a conference, then Dr. DeFeo does not attend it. Well, could it be if Dr. Burns attends a conference, could it be Drs. Albert and Evans? Could it be Albert and Evans and Burns? No, it couldn't be. Look at constraint, that last constraint. If Dr. Evans attends a conference, then either Dr. Albert or Dr. Burns, but not both, attends it. So it couldn't be Burns, who we're assuming, and Albert and Evans. So it can't be B. Could it be Calogero and DeFeo? No, it can't be. Constraint number, that second constraint. If Dr. Burns attends a conference, then either Calogero or DeFeo, but not both, attend it. So that but not both keeps that from happening. Could it be the fifth one, Dr. Evans? That's usually the if there's a wrong answer given, that's the wrong answer given. It can't be. Look at that, the combination of constraints two and three. You're assuming Burns attends the conference. Well, if Burns attends the conference, then either Calogero or DeFeo, but not both, attends it. And if Dr. Calogero attends the conference, then Dr. Evans does not attend it. So if Dr. Evans is there, then Dr. Calogero is not there. But Burns is there, and you wouldn't have either Calogero or DeFeo. So it can't be E, and so D is the only possible answer. It's got to be Dr. DeFeo. So that sort of reasoning is considered important by law schools in the LSAT test. So I would argue that this is a valid thing to teach students, these tools of learning. So let's finish by considering how we're to think of logic as Christians. First, we should note that God has given us tools of logic. We should teach our students. God has given these tools of logic, and to whom much is given, much is required. When you learn how to reason, and you're going to learn how to reason better, you better make sure that you're using it in a right way. We should make sure that you seek to glorify God in your use of logic. And that starts simply by thanking God. We need to be thankful for what He's given us. Thanking God for the ability to reason so that we can communicate clearly to each other, so that we can draw truth out of other information, so that we can speak with Him. And we need to be careful to use the gift of logic in an honorable way. Second, we need to recognize that like any other tool, logic can be dangerous. In teaching our students logic, we are giving them loaded guns. And all those guns are pointed this way at first, right at the teacher, right? And so that teacher needs to be ready to defend himself. And he needs to teach the students how to use gun safety. Be careful where you point that thing is an important rule to teach students. Let's practice with artificial targets first before we attack real people. Remind students that weapons are not to be used against friends and family. Weapons are to be used against enemies. Do not go to your mother and tell her she's made a formal or informal fallacy. We practice on targets first. And don't be quick on the trigger. Rather, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Tools of logic are dangerous. The tools of logic, like any other powerful thing, can be abused. Doug Wilson is fond of saying that we can educate devils, but we'll only get clever devils. If we give students these tools, but we don't train them in their proper use, they will misuse them. But if we fill students with the good things of the Word of God, then good things come out of students. How do we know what's in a man? By what comes out of a man. How do we know what's in our students? By what comes out. But if we give them these tools and they use them in a proper God-honoring way, then we're giving our students a gift that will benefit them for the rest of their lives. So my main point here is simply I want us to recognize that for students to learn learn tools of learning, they need to see it in more than just a logic class. They need to see it in other classes in the dialectic stage. And so we all need to be students of logic. Let me point you to one practical online tool, as other people I've seen do in the conference. I have an online logic forum where I take questions from logic teachers and logic students, and I encourage people to ask questions of each other. Simply look up Logos School, and it'll point you to my logic forum. I think it's called, I don't even know what it's called. I never click on it. I mean, I click on it, but I never type it in. But it's there. I could probably find it. But let me take some questions. Any questions you have? Yes, sir. That's a great question. One of the things that students learn in that very exercise is that the vast majority of errors that are made are not formal fallacies. Most people don't make formal valid errors. And so the practical method of learning, the practical reason that we learn rules of validity is not to identify formal fallacies made by others. It rarely happens. The real practical part of it is so that we can write our own proofs that are valid, so that we can, and I didn't talk about enthymemes, but the rules of validity help us to determine what's being assumed in an enthymeme, and there's a real value there, and you need to know the rules of validity to determine what's being assumed, and they help us to establish our own valid conclusions rather than invalid ones. But you're right. During a debate, you wouldn't have anything beyond the most basic of the formal fallacies being made. The informal fallacies are obvious and immediate and practical, but the practical nature of the formal fallacies is more in terms of establishing our own conclusions rather than analyzing somebody else's. And they just need to know that. No. Yeah, the way I do it is basically I teach through categorical logic first. I teach through my introductory logic textbook first, and then we go into debate there. Because by that time the students have learned how to define terms, how to determine the truth of statements. They've learned basic if-then reasoning, and they've learned the informal fallacies. And it's only at that point, and they've learned how to establish the truth of a conclusion in a categorical logic way. And so that's, I think, a good time to then go into formal debate and to get them using these tools in a real practical way. Okay. Other questions?
Can you tell us the difference between informal and formal logic?
Sure, yeah. Formal logic deals directly with reasoning, with drawing conclusions from other information. Informal logic is the sort of reasoning that we go through to help us support that process. So defining terms is what I would put under informal logic, because you define terms in order to then go and analyze an argument. Or determining the truth of statements I put under informal logic because that supports the process of drawing a conclusion. But it's not itself drawing a conclusion. Right? If I said, it's true that my name is Jim Nance, there's no reasoning I have to go through there. I know the truth of that statement for lots of reasons. But if I then said, anybody named Jim Nance at this conference is a logic teacher, and my name is Jim Nance, therefore I'm a logic teacher, that's formal logic, because there I'm drawing a conclusion. So that's the main distinction. Informal logic is used to support the background, the stuff we need to do before we can study the formal logic of reasoning itself. And so if you define logic as the science and the art of reasoning, it's really a definition of formal logic. And informal logic is that which supports that. Other questions? Yes, sir. Nope. Have you?
No.
Oh. Okay. Well, we're in the same boat. Anybody understand what he just said? I don't understand what he just said. Sorry. I've not studied. I've studied predicate logic beyond this. I love predicate logic. It's a lot of fun. It's gone a little bit into term logic, but haven't gone into meta logic or the other, you know, higher levels at all. Other questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely. So if you say you're a first year teacher, you're about to teach logic, you've never taught it before, what would I suggest? Does that get to your question? What I would read? Okay. Yeah, in support of the text. So the first thing that I would do is, if I was about to teach logic, is I would work through the text, all of the text, the whole thing, before day one of teaching. And then to support that, in support of the text, I think probably, definitely the teacher should be working through college-level logic texts. Probably the best there is The Art of Reasoning by David Kelly. The Art of Reasoning is one of the clearest logic textbooks written for college students and above. Very good at explaining things, lots and lots of exercises, and he gives really hard problems, you know, that make me think hard. I got to tell you a story. There was one formal proof that I found in a David Kelly text, and I was teaching formal proofs to my students, and I knew that I want to keep myself sharp, so I want to challenge myself. So there was this really, really hard proof that he put in his text, and I said, well, I think I'll give myself some time to work on this. So I knew I had a couple hours, went to the library to work on this proof, worked on it, tried so many different things, could not come up with the proof of this particular argument. Went back to class the next day and had some students finishing up their assignments early, and I just taught them how to do formal proofs of validity. And so I thought, I'll keep some of these students busy. And I put up this argument. I said, see if you could prove this argument. Ha ha ha, I'm thinking to myself, they'll never figure this one out. This will keep them busy the rest of the hour. 15 minutes later, you know, up comes Caroline Jones. Says, Mr. Nance, I think I've got it figured out. It's a 14-step proof, and she had it. And so I now call that particular proof the Caroline Jones proof. And every year I teach my students the Caroline Jones proof. It's, you know, and that's something I learned from that little exercise, is that often my students are sharper than me because they're right at that stage where all of this makes sense, it's natural, and it's humbling. So The Art of Reasoning by David Kelly is one good place. For informal fallacies, I would point you to the Blue Dorn brothers, the Trivium Pursuit people, Fallacy Detective, and what's the other one? Yeah, Thinking Toolbox. The Thinking Toolbox. Two excellent books. The Fallacy Detective is well written. One of my favorite parts about The Fallacy Detective is the little discussion, the fact that it was written by the two brothers, and sometimes they don't always agree, and the discussions that happen in the answer key are fun to read. So those are, you know, for the formal logic and the informal logic, those are two good places to go. Did that answer your question? You're welcome. How much time do I have? What time am I supposed to be done here? 5 minutes ago? Okay, other questions? Yeah, other questions you can come ask me. Thank you very much.